You know, I think had it been known that this was going to be Cosby night, I don't think really that I and this one here would have been out. And I really don't think that they would have hired a hall to get such a gorgeous captive audience. But seriously, it has been an exciting thing to come to this garden spot of the world, which Lynchburg, Virginia, is always to us. And what a marvelous feast of people and friends. You know, when I walked past Jim and Mary Jane Old, I thought, isn't that remarkable? His name is Jim. He looks so much like Jim Old. And I'm so delighted to realize that they are our old and dear friends. The woods and the meadows behind the houses of the Cosbys and the Harrises and the Tenniels and the Edmonds on Boonesboro Road, for many years of my teenage years, were important and vivid parts of my life. Because lots went on in those woods. Not what you're thinking. There was a blacksmith shop behind Mr. Edmonds' house. But there were also other exciting things. There were things like sapling trees that all the neighborhood boys climbed to the top of and bent over in a low sweep, touching the earth. Only the brave did that. I was much too timid. There were pillow fights on skinned logs across the stream back there. The pillars were on Kathleen Cosby's front porch. There were balloons that were tacked up on the trees and shot with 22 rifles for target practice. And in one great day, I remember that all the woods were equipped with hoses underground and bottles in the trees secretly, and then $25, that was an enormous amount of money, $25 was offered any one of the young men who would stay in the hollow overnight. And any number of them attempted, and with the ooze and the tinkling of the bottles manipulated from the garage, none of them ever did. It's good. It's good that they didn't really have $25. They saw to it that they all came out. The one who was the most stalwart was a young man who came rushing out shortly after the witching hour, singing at the top of his lungs, "I need Jesus." Now, you know, during those days, I was not aware that it was holy ground on which we were standing and playing and laughing and singing and doing all sorts of things. But perhaps I got a hint of it when young Frank Burkholder, who was just out of the army, got his first earth-loading equipment. Do you remember how enormous it looked? And he was so young, and Bob as well. And when the two Burkholder boys shaved off the top of the hill to make the ball field, and it seemed that things were getting serious. Perhaps another hint, when the family, the Cosby boys, were then joined by Jim Old and Wesley Schrader, and then along with Frank would walk back and join people like Mildred Edmonds and Betty Thompson, and they would sit, and Elizabeth Gordon, and they would sit for a long time talking about who would play on that ball field and what sort of thing would happen, because already Jack Cosby in those days was sort of the Pied Piper of the group. There was an interesting thing about Jack. Boys of all ages and girls as well would sense his arrival from the veteran, you know, savings and loan. They would sense when he got home from work, and they would swarm like bees on the Cosby's back steps. And it was very clear that these children, these young people who gathered in those early days around that little group, were vital and eager and wide open to the enlarging of their horizons, the deepening of their commitment. And there was often a feeling that there was a real discrepancy in the churches, the very churches which they loved and were so loyal to, between the faith that was proclaimed and at the way it was embodied in the lives of people. Indeed, it seemed to that little group that the churches often were highly selective in even their proclaiming of the faith. It was often not even made applicable to those who were unaccepted by society, the poor, the prisoners, the moral misfits. It didn't seem to be appropriate, the good news, always. And then those children were not always central stream Protestants. There were Catholics, and there were Jews, and there seemed something basically wrong with the competitive churchmanship, when even Presbyterian and Baptist children didn't know each other, much less Catholics and Jews. That early group, and they were young, and they were gifted, and they were adventurous. And they felt, I think, that in the healing of those divisions, even in those days, there would be fulfillment of their own lives. Beverly has reflected this in the years in which he wrote about some time ago, about the years of the Lynchburg Covenant Fellowship, and he divided it into four basic sections. Let me share with you what he wrote then. The first 5 years were the novel years of exploration and adventure. These were the dramatic years. These years were characterized by youthful idealism, by the excitement of risk-taking, by making decisions on the basis of intuition and impulse rather than calculation, on faith rather than logic. It seems to me that the LCF in those early days acted contrary to the native temperaments of the members of the group. Most were rather logical people, conservative and timid by temperament and training, and they were trained in all that was proper and safe in Southern culture. But when it came to money matters, this little group seemed unhampered by the fact that it would have to pay more for a piece of land than it was thought to be worth, or to borrow money out of proportion to its limited resources. The land that was thought to be worth $100 an acre cost $400 an acre. Since the seller was willing to take a note for $8,000 without any down payment, with a $500 payment on principal at the end of the year, with plus $300 interest, it seemed like the thing to do. At that time, a year seemed like a long time. And surely a dozen young people could round up at $800 a year from somewhere during the next 15 years. When it came to the more important matters like prejudice, we thought, of course, we didn't have any. And when we talked about racial justice, we assumed that any Christian fellowship would naturally be open to everybody, and that all we'd have to do would be to announce it, that the Lynchburg Christian Fellowship would be integrated, interracial, and all-inclusive, and it would be all very simple. We didn't know anything about the depth and dimension of this or any other problem at that time, but with a complete naivete, forged ahead like food marching in where angels fit. Those were the years when my father, Mr. Cosby, gave acres off the old home place, and when we manipulated an additional 35 acres along with a debt of $50,000, when the athletic field was built and the summer day camp begun and the vision was very much alive among a very limited number of people. These were the fun years, the youthful years, the naive years, the simple years. The second period was quite different, almost the reversal of the first. These were the lean years of frustration. As happens to most of us in life, idealism turns to realism, and disillusionment sets in, and it takes its toll. About half the committed nucleus scattered as the natural consequences of a mobile society. One young woman was even killed in an automobile accident at the intersection of 11th and Pierce Streets on the way home from a Christmas pageant. And as the community And as the novelty wore off, and no great success was imminent, when naturally these things happened, people lost interest. In spite of the momentum that of earlier years, the already small number dwindled. It became apparent that there would be fewer and fewer people. For some reason, after 1954, fewer seemed enamored with the idea of integration. At a time when more of us, when many of us did not know an eyeball-to-eyeball relationship with a black person at all, but hoped one day it might be a reality. This was a time of standing still, of treading water, of keeping the grass mowed and the day calf operating, of working without inspiration, of keeping the rumor alive, and all the while questioning not only the feasibility, but the validity of that which had been begun. St. Gregory said, all holy desires grow by delays, and if such desires fade because of those delays, then they never were holy desires. The third period of the early 60s was altogether different. Still, in many ways, more difficult, more traumatic, more frightening, and also more satisfying. This was the time of confrontation, open confrontation, characterized by repeated conflict and community pressure. Looking back on it, we can see that it was a time of most significant breakthroughs, although at that time we couldn't have recognized or acknowledged it. On a Monday morning in July 1961, two energetic, attractive little 8-year-old blacks quietly enrolled in the day camp and began a wonderful day with 40 or 50 other children. It was truly a good day. The children were good, the program was good, the weather was good, the swimming was good, the spirit was good, and everybody had a marvelous time, campers and counselors alike. But by Monday afternoon, the Lynchburg Christian had become the object of great interest to all of Lynchburg for the first time in 11 years. By the end of that week, the Lynchburg Covenant Fellowship had many unseen friends and many seen and unseen enemies it had never met before. This was the occasion when we knew at last that we had made the first direct live contact with one of the great issues of history. This was a logical consequence of what we had affirmed for the past 11 years, but which had never happened. We had naively thought it might have happened any time along the way, but being who we were, it is a miracle that it happened when it did. Some of us still recall the trauma of that week. The remaining 4 weeks of camp continued with 12 or 14 children and a counselor camper ratio of 1 to 2. The following summer was spent building back on an integrated basis. This was the first of a series of serious confrontations which were to follow during the next several years. It was my first experience of seeing a Molotov cocktail in the driveway. It would take a long time to spell out the unfolding of the first 5 years of the 60s. There were a lot of blunders, very serious violations, many things we might have done differently, many things we could have done we didn't do, and we need to acknowledge our responsibility for them. We need to confess and to seek forgiveness from those who have been hurt along the way. And I think we can safely say that this period of confrontation with a larger community and this time of struggle was a real breakthrough when we entered into a dimension of life and began to learn what we needed to know. I think we can be grateful for those years. The physical symbol which must remind us of those years is the swimming pool, which providentially or coincidentally was completed in June before that July Monday. During that summer and several summers following, some folk would look over the pool fence on a summer day, a hot day, and say, why did you do it? Do what, we'd ask? Prevent us from swimming on a day like this, they'd say. Far from preventing you, we encourage you. The day is hot, the water is good, you're invited to swim. One discovered that there was a distinct relationship between the temperature of the sun and the quantity of the antagonist. Also, the quality and the quantity of the integration. The first 15 years were the preparation for the opportunities of the next 5. And then in the 4th, the 5 years after that, of the 60s, were a time of increasing participation in the city. In 1966, there emerged in the Lynchburg Covenant Fellowship an expanding awareness of urban problems plaguing most American cities, including Lynchburg. We are embarrassed that this awareness was so slow in coming. Then a few more people appeared on the scene who seemed eager to share the vision and to make themselves available to implement the vision. A few more gifts were given, and probably the changing climate helped with the possibilities. Through a providential sequence of events, PG came on the executive as director of the LCF in March of 1966, and soon after that, Hazel Bulwer, who many of you know, with her many capacities and charisma of her spirit, became deeply involved in Kumbaya. That same year, 1966, the old Victorian mansion at 412 Madison Street was bought, and the Kumbaya Ecumenical Center begun. Some 16 sponsoring churches in 1966 had begun to participate, and before the end of 1966, the contract was negotiated for 700 Federal Street and again more housing. And then, 4 years later, the Shalom Apartments were begun. And then the last 5 years. For in these last 5 years, new things happen. As the psalmist said, unless the Lord watches over the city, the watchmen stay awake in vain. Isaiah the prophet said, and you and your ancient ruins shall be rebuilt, and you shall raise up the foundation of many generations. You shall be called repairers of the breach, restorer of the streets and the cities to dwell. And then City Gate. And the words of the dreamers of City Gate are, City Gate means motivation. City Gate is an enabling catalyst. City Gate is a ministry for people. City Gate says that a small number of people with commitment and vision can make a difference in the world. City Gate has a vision for your city. You can have a vision for your city. Envision your city as a place where the spirit of man is enhanced. Envision your city as a place where the uniqueness of each person is able to find expression. Envision your city as a place where all the systems that support life work for all the people. Envision your city as opportunity. City Gate. It works behind the scene to bring people from every part of your city to a round table. And it works planning and development. It works the physical, economic, and social systems. Really have faith that there can be a whole and a new community. Repairers of the breach, rebuilders of the city. In 1973, Herbert Moore spoke to the Lynchburg Covenant Fellowship and said this, Shirley and I are now ready to live out the rest of our lives with you in love and friendship as God's creators in an onward march and an inward and outward giving. And City Gate was truly born. You know, most of us are adjusters. Society is made up of adjusters. We adjust to horrors of our society and even become accustomed to them. Coleman McCarthy described our horrors as our corporate irresponsibility. Nationally, we adjust to it. Our militarism, we adjust to it. The pollution of our land, we adjust to it. The deception of our government, we adjust to it. All the way down to small daily irks and things that bother us, such as ice cream containing 50% air and mostly paraffin for the rest. Contaminated meat. Weak old cars needing major repairs. And more. We adjust to outdated welfare systems and a welfare system that doesn't work for anybody. It keeps the poor poor. It keeps him on the dole and degraded. It promotes the breaking up of families, and it costs all citizens inordinately. We adjust. We adjust to a prison system made up of penitentiaries that make nobody penitent, and reformatories which do not even attempt to reform. And along with the punitive degrading of prisoners, the cost of keeping a prisoner in prison these days is enough to send him to Harvard Graduate School, and we pay him. In addition, we're scared stiff. We adjust. We get more guns, we turn on more lights, we use up more energy, we lock our doors tighter and put on more security locks, and then we hire more policemen. We adjust. But tonight, we celebrate the fact that in this lovely city of Seven Hills, close by the Blue Ridge Mountains, rooted in the graciousness of the South, that it is always known, a city of good businesses and growing industries, of superior colleges, of steepled churches and synagogue alert to the needs of the people in a new way in this new era of the 70s. Tonight we celebrate the fact that among you here are the non-adjusters, those who quietly take a stance of non-compliance in a society that has forgotten how to dream dreams and has long since seen a vision. In the last days of the land of Judah, before the Babylonian captivity, when the city of Jerusalem was completely surrounded and there was no hope, and the pain and the suffering are beyond description, and people were gathering up their belongings because they knew that the Babylonians would enter the city and carry them away into captivity, which indeed they did. And as the city had fallen and the hunger was rampant and the thirst so great, Jeremiah the prophet went out and bought a piece of real estate. And the book of Jeremiah is very careful in the describing of it. It says Jeremiah did it very properly. He got all the proper legal papers. He got it properly sealed and delivered and signed and legally done so that it was a secure real estate deal, and he paid a large sum of money for a piece of land which the Babylonians were now taking over. And as always, the adjusters said to him, Jeremiah, as always, you've lost your mind. And Jeremiah said, don't you believe it. One of these days, houses and lands will again be bought in this land. Now the builders of the city, the repairers of the breach, those who are given the gift of seeing a vision and dreaming a dream, of the non-adjusters, Lynchburg Covenant Fellowship is a bunch of gorgeous non-adjusters. I commend you, I celebrate you, and I'm deeply grateful to be among you.
Lives and loves and works together for 25 years. It builds together a common heritage. And together creates quite a story. As is clear from Mary's remarks, we have a story to tell of what God has done to us and through us. It's a fascinating story and will be told differently by each participant in it. It's important that we know our story and that we rejoice in it and that we learn to tell it well. And then decide together whether we should continue the story. I think we should not too easily assume that we should launch ourselves into another 25 years, or even another 5, or even another 1. There are entirely too many mediocre institutions. There are very few institutions of excellence. Perhaps people would be better off if more institutions went out of existence. It is very difficult for an institution to die a clean death because its work has been done and there are no longer called people in it. An institution goes on the basis of institutional momentum. It is important, I think, to at least ask the question seriously, are we being called into a future? Should we continue? Now, to help with that question, I would like to look at our past in light of the covenant by which we have been bound and the peculiar nature of that covenant. What has been the really unique thing about our call? In the amazing mercy of God, we often do that which is deeply significant in shaping history, when all the while we've been unconscious of what has made our actions so significant. To some degree, I believe this has been true of the Lynchburg Covenant Fellowship. We have, I believe, shaped history. But what is it that has been our uniqueness? What is it that has made us more than a social service organization or an institution spawning many varied efforts? There has been a special charism. What is it? Now, there are many things which to me are exciting and which are deeply significant about the fellowship. First, I want to mention one which to me is especially significant, and that is that the fellowship is not a superficial, loose fellowship, but a covenant fellowship of Jews and Christians. And what a gift that is. I read a quotation from Jacques Ellul recently, which to me is a tremendously important statement. He says, Israel is a people centered on hope, living by that hope alone, a hope always carried through and never actualized, a people accustomed to the silence of God, acquainted with his abandonment, yet living by hope nevertheless. As the one hoping people of the world, it is Israel which provides us with a model for this age. Since being broken as a nation, it has buried itself in the incognito, outwardly accepting the manners and customs of the peoples in whose midst it is settled. It is nevertheless always different, displaced, unlike, incapable of the sociological or spiritual communion forever set before it. It is unlike because it has a hope which is incarnate. It lives this hope as a people in a secret, mysterious, and hidden, yet always rigorous and total way. It is united by the spiritual tie of an absoluteness, always close-knit, steeped in the secret of its festivals, its traditions, its chants, and its prayers, always entirely amiable and forming all possible relationships, yet at the same time completely firm regarding the most serious of all things, the deep well. It strictly conserves the spotless content of Revelation and thereby maintains unity among its members. Because they have such energy and intelligence, a sign of depth, they have it in them to do great things and to occupy the top positions in every society in which they're found. We don't have time to go into it because of our time tonight, but Elul says that Christians are in a position today similar to that of Israel in the first and second centuries, and Israel has found the true answer to this situation, an answer which has made it possible for it to come through 2,000 years of persecution, and much of that persecution at the hands of Christians. It has lived for 2,000 years in incognito, and it has lived in a steadfast hope. Thus, Israel can be a model for us now as we move into the future, which will be similar to that which Israel has already gone through. Now, for us to wait together in hope for the mighty God to perform his mighty acts in Lynchburg is a tremendous gift. Now, what has been our real uniqueness as we have waited together? Let me say what I think it is. You can say what you think it is. But what I think it is this. Although we have not been nearly as radical as we might have been, and as I have hoped we would be, at least we have begun to identify ourselves with the powerless of our society, and thus the victimized and the oppressed. The powerless are always oppressed because of their powerlessness. Our liberating God has always been especially concerned with the poor and the powerless who suffer in peculiar ways because of their weakness. You will recall the call of our father Moses. He was being confronted by God in the burning bush, and God speaks to him and says, I have seen the misery of my people in Egypt. I have heard their outcry against their slave masters. I have taken heed of their sufferings and have come down to rescue them from the power of Egypt. Another passage in Isaiah, the 41st chapter. The wretched and the poor look for water and find none. Their tongues are parched with thirst, but I, the Lord, will give them an answer. I, the God of Israel, will not forsake them. I will open rivers among sand dunes and wells in the valleys. I will turn the wilderness into pools and dry lands into springs of water. And in Amos, God is concerned, and Amos is furious because they, the power structure, grind the heads of the poor into the earth. They oppress the poor and they crush the destitute. And if there's anything that we can know about Yahweh, the God of Jews and of Christians, it is that he loves the poor and the weak. Any society that remains even relatively sane will have a remnant of people who identify in a radical way with the poor. When there is no longer this remnant, then all is lost, and the world is not even aware that it is insane. When you look at the whole human family, our global village, it's not a pretty picture. You'll find at the top the wealthy, the powerful, the highly educated, the affluent, the influential. They've carved out a place for themselves. They have secured themselves as best they can against the exigencies of a capricious existence. They, I should say we, have built institutions which secure these privileges and make it almost impossible for them to be shared. That's at the top. At the bottom of the poor, the impotent. Their minds and gifts never developed, the dumping ground of human life. They couldn't even tell you what the human potential movement is, much less have entered into its stream. They are buffeted to and fro because of their helplessness. They have no one to protect them, no one to see to their rights. They are the lonely ones. They are in prison and psychiatric hospitals. They are children in the welfare system. They are jobless. They are hungry. They are thirsty. Their options are extremely limited. They have no place. They are not wanted. And in their present state, they couldn't possibly build institutions to protect their interests. Our uniqueness consists, I believe, in a beginning attempt, and I think that's all it is, a beginning attempt to feel the suffering of the poor and to hear the cry of the wretched, because this is the nature of our God. Many things make this special call difficult, if not impossible. Most of us have emotional and psychological need to go up, to be successful, to be powerful, to have authority, to be accredited as tops in whatever system we find ourselves, the system of the church. Last week I was in a seminar and a retreat for the faculty of the students, and almost all of the students that I talked to were on their way up in the system. It's true in church, it's true in business, it's true in political life, it's true in the educational field, in every phase of life. And a person on his way up finds it almost impossible to see the Pharaoh, the oppressor, the Egypt, which develops within us and is responsible for the suffering that we knew when we were in Egypt. And we were there because that's our heritage. And having our quota of work increased and the added burden of finding our own straw to make the break. And you recall when the foreman came and they protested to the staff of Pharaoh. They said, get to work again, you're lazy, you're lazy. You see, it takes a miracle of grace to see the Pharaoh in oneself. And until a miracle is granted, it is not possible to hear the groans of the oppressed. Pharaoh's heart is always hardened. The exercise of power so consumes one and so feeds one's hubris and demands such attention that one's heart is hardened and capacity for compassion is diminished. Pharaoh simply could not hear. He couldn't hear the anguish of parents commanded to throw every newborn male Hebrew child into the Nile. And it's strange that we have such difficulty hearing the cries of the poor in the city. Rather than asking what's wrong with us, we ask what's wrong with them, that they remain poor and weak. What's wrong with us that we cannot feel their pain in unemployment and underemployment, in sickness because of poor food and inadequate medical attention? What keeps us from crying out in defense of a fellow human being who is being buffeted by the cruelties of nature and human nature, saying, I will stand beside you, I will love you, I will protect you, I will be your advocate, even to the most repulsive in our society? It's amazing how beautiful they are when we come to know them. I've lived a long time and I've heard a lot of beautiful music. The most beautiful music I've ever heard in my life was sung tonight by that group who was with us. But the problem is that one cannot be on one's way up and at the same time hear the deep cries of the suffering. And so what we are really talking about is what Mary was suggesting to us. We're talking about the problem of non-adjustment. And I wish, as she implied, that we were a group of non-adjusted people. But it's just not true. It's not true. The difficulty of non-adjustment as a way of life has long concerned Rabbi Abraham Heschel. And he tells a story, and you'll never be able to forget it. Once upon a time in a kingdom long ago and far away, it happened that after a grain crop had been harvested and stored, it was discovered to be poison. Anyone who ate it went insane. The king and his advisors immediately took counsel as to what should be done. Clearly, not enough food was available from other sources to sustain the population. There was no choice but to eat the grain. Very well, the king decided, let us eat it. But at the same time, we must feed a few people in a different diet so that there will be among us some who remember that we are insane. Now, let me return to the question with which I began. Do we have a future? Should we continue for another year? And the answer hangs on the answer to another question. Do we have a small core of people called by God to radically espouse the cause of the poorest of the poor? To eat another diet, and thus have a few among us who remember that we are insane. Do we have a few amongst us who, in the presence of the wretched and the poor, will, with God, look for water for the poor and will help the God of Israel open rivers among the sand dunes and wells in the valley, who will help to turn the wilderness into pools and dry lands into springs of water? Do we have just a few people who have that call? And then are there others of us who will support these non-adjusted ones and make their sanity possible on behalf of an insane society? A short time ago, a sampling was made by experts in the city to test whether it was possible to launch a major financial campaign to support the fellowship ministers. And the answer came back no. And the question was asked why, and the answer came back too low a profile in Lynchburg. And my intuitive response was, hallelujah. My guess is that the profile will always be too low if we really remain faithful to our call. If we are sufficiently radical, it will always remain low. Those on their way up will not rejoice with those who are on their way down into the weird depths of human wretchedness. A sacrificial level of support must come from those of us here who have glimpsed the vision and for a moment have tasted what it means to be sane. Do we have a future? Shall we continue? Does Yahweh still will that we be in covenant with him and with one another to lift the burdens of his people? How do you answer it?
Thank you, Gordon and Mary. I know that you join with me in saying that we are profoundly grateful for these dynamic messages. But let these messages not remain within these corridors, but let each of us, as we go down from this celebration tonight, decide within ourselves that we are going to accept the challenge and move forward from this day on. Again, we want to express our sincere appreciation to all of our guests, our participants, especially Gordon and Mary, for coming down and bringing us such eloquent messages. And to each of you for your presence, for your participation, for your past, present, and anticipated support. This time, I'm going to call on the Vice President of the LCF to give the benediction. And we hope that as you leave, you will meditate on these messages. Again, our thanks this time to Dwee Mark Cardwell, Vice President, a gentleman and a scholar. Will, we arrive.
My Heavenly Father, we are filled with gratitude for this experience of mine. We thank you again for those people who have given of themselves for the sustained high vision of the Lynchburg Covenant Fellowship and who have inspired us over the past 25 years, as many have inspired us tonight. We thank you for those who, at various times, have provided strategic needs to the fellowship, labor, material gifts, words of wisdom and encouragement. Be with the ministries of the LCF. May we look to those needs which lie ahead and committed in our response. Make us instruments of reconciliation, joy, and new life in challenges that await us. As we leave, may we feel the mutual support of each other. May your grace, peace, and love go with us and remain in us always. Amen. Amen.